Turn off your cell phones. Good evening and welcome to Lesson 3, Taking Leave, Our Evolving Relationship with the Departed. There's quite a few of our students that are out of town this week, are not feeling well this week, but the class will be just as much fun. Suzanne, we'll start with you with the introduction right there at the beginning. In death, is death.
Taking Leave, Our Evolving Relationship with the Departed. Is death painful for the soul? Does the soul of the deceased retain any attachment to this world, to its body, to its loved ones? This lesson discusses the Jewish Quran and some of the traditions associated with the moment of passing, the preparation of the body for burial, the funeral, interment, and grave visitation. All of these inform us about the nature of the soul's continuing relationship with its life in this world and those that it loves.
And so, in the past weeks, we've discussed the eternity of the soul, the program, some of what goes on with the soul, and tonight, we're going to deal with the reality of the soul from the moment that the soul leaves the body until it's interred in the ground. From the body, from the soul's departure from the body to interment. And it, you know, you think that you look at the soul's departure from the body and it signals a new beginning, the onset of a new phase in the soul's journey based on everything we said before. The soul's eternal, so when a person passes away, what we call when a person dies, so it's no longer attached and tethered to the foreign object, the foreign material called a body. And now it's free to soar to the greatest of spiritual heights and go to the highest of realms. So now, that's what we would think. We think that the moment you pass away, you're going into that new phase. When you go into that new phase, it's a great thing for the soul. What actually happens when the soul leaves the body? So, what we're going to begin when we get to text 1 is going to be a quote from the book Tanya. Tanya is the magnum opus of Chabad Hasidism. It was written, different parts of it was written in the late 1700s by the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad. And in this particular letter that we're going to touch upon, which we already shared parts of it in Lesson 1, it's a letter that the Alter Rebbe wrote in 1788. And he wrote this letter to the grief-stricken Hasidim who had lost their Hasidic master. So, for those that are not familiar with the world of Hasidism, it's like students and a rabbi, but on a much deeper level. And Reb Mendel Haradukar was his name, known as Reb Mendel of Vitebsk, or Reb Mendel Haradukar. He had two names based on two different cities that he lived in. Eventually, he moved to Eretz Yisrael, he moved to Israel, lived in the city of Tiberias in the north, in Tiberia. And when he passed away, his Hasidim, like is the case with many Hasidim, when they lose their Rebbe's physical presence, it's a very, very big loss. And they, you know, the physical absence of their master takes a big toll on them. And so, we're going to go read this letter, and before we go there, I just want to give you some a little bit of a intro so you know what he's talking about. The soul has five levels. Every soul has five levels. The levels that we're going to talk about tonight in the beginning of this class are known as Nefesh and Ruach. Nefesh refers to the biological soul, which means the soul that actually gives our physical body life. There's no depth to it, it's just the physical. When we say someone is a living organism, it needs a living organism. Every living organism needs a soul that keeps it alive in the blood flow. That is called Nefesh. Ruach is perhaps a deeper level of soul, and Ruach represents the emotional, the feelings of the individual. So it's their soul as it reflects, as it expresses itself on an emotional level, which is obviously much deeper than just the biological, physical function of the body. So if you look at figure 3.1, there's Nefesh, physical, biological life, and where does it locate itself after the body's demise? In the grave. So this is very important, and I want to stop right here. We'll get to it in depth, but we need to pause for a moment to recognize that it's not only the body that we go to, the dead body in a grave that we go and we visit a gravesite. It's not only about dead bodies. There's the nefesh of the body, the biological spirit that kept the spirit of the biological human being that kept it alive remains at the gravesite where the body is buried. What about the ruach? What about the soul of feeling and emotion? That goes to Gan Eden, that goes to paradise. Now let's look at the Alter Rebbe's letter. Now that we got a few things out of the way, let's look at what the Alter Rebbe actually writes in this letter. Remember, put it in the context of what it is. He's consoling the Hasidim of Rav Mendel of Vitebsk in 1788 for the passing of their master, their Hasidic master, Rav Mendel. Linda, go ahead, text 1A.
As it is known, the life of the tzaddik is not physical but spiritual, and it consists of faith and reverence and love for God. While the tzaddik is alive on earth, these three attributes, as they are comprised in the soul's ruach component, inhabit a defined physical space, for they are contained in their vessel and garment, the nefesh that is bound to the body. Consequently, all the tzaddik's disciples receive but the glow of these attributes, a ray that is emitted from the vessel, the body, by means of the tzaddik's holy words and thoughts. Indeed, because a student can only relate to a reflection of the teacher's attributes, not his essence, our sages of blessed memory said that it takes 40 years for a student to fully plumb the depths of his master's teaching. And that's from the Talmud of Avodah Zarah. After the tzaddik's passing, however, the nefesh remains in the grave and separates from the ruach and its three attributes, which are now in Gan Eden. Therefore, whoever is close to the tzaddik can receive directly from his ruach in Gan Eden, because the ruach is no longer contained in a vessel or confined to a specific physical space. Therefore, it is very easy for the tzaddik's disciples to connect with the essence of their master's ruach, the faith, awe, and love with which he served God, and not merely a ray thereof, which is emitted beyond the vessel. Each student connects and receives commensurate to his loving connection and closeness to the tzaddik during his lifetime and after his death. For the transmission of all things spiritual is always by means of great love.
This is a very, very fundamental letter that the Alter Rebbe wrote based on the teachings of the Zohar with a little bit of Talmud, but primarily based on the foundational teachings of the Kabbalah, the mystical part of the Torah. And it goes like this. What is a person's life? When you look back at a person's life, if they were totally permeated with materialism and physicality, so when they die, as we mentioned in earlier lessons, most of what we know about them goes with it, because that's what they were full of. If a person's life is love, fear, awe, and reverence and faith of God, in God, and that was what they were fully encompassed with, fearing God, loving God, being faithful to God, and unfortunately, because they were in a physical body, that's the reality, the expression of their ruach, the expression of their deeper soul, the expression of their emotional bond with God, and the way that is expressed to the people around them, had to go through the fact that they were a human being, which means it had to go through the biological soul. So naturally it became limited by the fact that they were in a physical body that has limitations. Because no matter how you twist it, no matter how righteous the individual, from Moses and downward, they're in a physical body, and by definition, if you're in a physical body, you are limited. And so no matter how powerful your ruach may be, it becomes watered down to a certain extent by the nefesh, even if it's the nefesh of a tzaddik, of a righteous person. The moment they pass away, at that very moment, the ruach, their emotional expression of godliness, is now unleashed. It's separated from the limitations of the body, of the nefesh, whatever you want to call it, but it's separated from that limitation. So not only is it not less connected to the individuals that want to connect to the soul, it's more connected because now it's unleashed in Gan Eden, it's unleashed in the Garden of Eden, in paradise, but it's unleashed with a force that never existed when it was alive in this world. And so, should you want to tap into that, whether you had a relationship with that righteous person when they were alive, and through that loving relationship, it's being reciprocated now, much stronger than before, because it doesn't have the limitations anymore, or even if you didn't know that individual, that righteous person when they were alive, by connecting with what they stood for, whether it's their teachings, their guidance, their ideals, at that moment now you become connected to them, but to them not limited by their physical being. And so number one, as it relates to us, whether you, even though we're using the example of a righteous person, doesn't have to be a tzaddik. Every person has the tzaddik within them and has the righteous person within them. It also, we have moments that we behave like righteous people. And so we can connect to a person's ruach more than ever before. But not only as it relates to our relationship with them, for them themselves. Now this is tricky. Even for the righteous person themselves, the fact that they are not limited by their physical body has a benefit for them, not only for us. What would the benefit be? Frank, look at 1b, go ahead.
It is known that all the effort of man, that his soul toiled during his lifetime, remains above, in a hidden and concealed state. It becomes revealed and then radiates in a manifest way from above downwards at the moment of a person's passing.
So tzaddik, a righteous person, has a, let's just use our terminology, he has a soul that operates in HD. But he doesn't, he has a DVD that operates in HD DVD, an HD DVD high definition, but his machine that he's in, the body, doesn't have the capability of showing it to you in HD. And so now that he's free of the body, he's able to experience his feelings, his emotion, his relationship with Hashem, that tzaddik himself is able to have that relationship with Hashem in a way that when in the body couldn't have it because it had a certain limitation. And so all those ideals, beautiful ideals, feelings, emotions, and principles that are rooted in the ruach, that are rooted in the emotional, in the depth of the heart and soul of the tzaddik, are now able to connect through love, through the love and relationship that we have with them. We're able to connect with that on a much greater level than before. You know, we always joke, I say we, in Orthodox communities, we always joke growing up, you know, the Torah portions in Leviticus, the order of the portions in the end, it goes Achrei Mos. There's a portion called Achrei Mos, which means after the passing. It's the portion that talks about the passing of Aaron's two sons who died in the temple. The next portion is Kedoshim, the holy one, because it's all about holy activities of the Jew. Emor is the third one, which is Emor means to say to. And so we joke, we say Achrei Mos. After someone dies, Kedoshim Emor, everyone says that they were holy. Every time someone dies, suddenly there's eulogies and they were the best person you ever met and they were seriously, there was no one like them in the world. And it could be that one of the reasons we have a, people may think that one of the reasons we have a greater appreciation for people after they die, right? Why do we have a greater appreciation for people after they die?
Because the soul is free and we can
have... Oh, so you're already answering my question based on what we just said. Naturally, normally, when you, why do we say, without this class, why would we say nice things about people? Why do we suddenly appreciate people more after they die? Number one?
The loss.
Because you miss absence. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. So, number two is you don't see their negative side when they pass away. Right? They're not doing anything negative right now in front of you, so you have the opportunity to focus on their good without seeing something negative right in front of you that's making you crazy. And, but the truth is, they're also, you know, they're not around, and it's much easier to appreciate them now. But that's all superficial reasons. What we're saying here is what Stana said, that the real reason, based on what we just said, that we appreciate people more after their passing is not only because of these superficial reasons. We appreciate them more because indeed we're tapping into a part of them, to a side of them, that we never had the opportunity to tap into because it was limited by the experience with which we interacted, which was a bodily experience, and is therefore limited by the finite. And as Jews, we are not limited by finite. As human beings, we have the capability to reach above and beyond the finite. Unfortunately, when a person is in a physical body, it's very hard to tap into that. Once they leave the physical body, we have an easier opportunity to tap into that. If that's the case, if it's so super duper, right, when a person passes away, they have you unleashing the superpowers of the Ruach. Suddenly there's these great energetics that are coming from the soul. You'd think that both us and the deceased would be excited about it. Particularly the deceased. He or she is now able to tap into a side of them that for the 120 years that they lived in the physical body, they didn't have the opportunity to tap into it. Right? My Ruach is going rogue. It's going free. I finally am able to experience Ruach in a way I never did before. Yet, look at text number 2 straight out of the Zohar. Go ahead, Stana.
Nothing is hard for the soul as its separation from the body.
There is nothing harder for the soul than the fact that it separates from the body. So question for discussion is, why would death be difficult and painful for the soul?
You got all these desires that you're used to here and you're not able to satisfy them there.
You think spiritually, you're not able to do mitzvahs.
Well, that is part of it, but also physical desires.
You think the soul is worried that he can't have, you know, a burger?
I think some souls, yeah.
Mine
yes.
Yours would be.
You know, if the soul is feeling pain when it leaves the body, the obvious implication is that if you're much connected to this world and not tuned in to God and the spiritual world, that's where his focus is.
The soul?
Yeah.
You taught us at the first class that the souls didn't even want to come to Earth.
Right, and then I also thought they didn't want to leave.
For them.
It sounds right.
Do they remember Rabbi?
The soul? Absolutely. So number one, transitions are always hard. So let's not make it into fluff. The soul spent X amount of years, whether it's 120 or 70, 80, depending on how long they live. And in those years, the soul and the body got used to each other. So even though Jennifer points out correctly that in the first class we spoke about the fact that the soul doesn't want to come here, but once it comes here, this becomes home. And when, just like a child going to school the first day, stomps and screams and, you know, or any type of major transition, no one's happy with transitions. Most people don't like transitions, even if it's a good transition. We need to get used to it, and getting used to it takes time. The soul is no different. It needs to transition. More importantly, is that in this case, the body, like Joe sort of hinted to it, although he took it in the wrong direction, and that is, the soul becomes emotionally attached to the body. It recognizes that its mission on earth was only able to be accomplished. They were only able to accomplish the mission as a partnership between body and soul. And now that the body is finished with this idea called living, the soul now going to paradise, no matter how wondrous it may be, the soul isn't now in unison with the body and able to accomplish what it was able to accomplish in this world. And so it becomes very, very painful because the soul has learned to appreciate the partnership with the body and what the body has done for that partnership. Go ahead.
Rabbi Chaim, does the soul linger in around the body or in the space surrounding the body for a time?
Very good question, which is what we're going to tackle right now. So if that's the case, that the soul doesn't want to leave the body, what's the greatest way you create a transition? You don't do it overnight. You don't go from one extreme to the other extreme overnight. If you're trying to detox someone, I highly recommend, even not being an expert, that you don't detox them overnight from from total alcoholism or drug abuse to nothing. People die every day from withdrawal, real withdrawal. The soul also can have a great, great negative withdrawal effect from just separating from the body. Oh, it's free, it's unleashing its ruach. No. There's a program for that too. If the soul would have to do it instantly, it would be the most painful thing. As it is, it's painful. Doing it instantly without a process, without it progressing to a place where it could slowly make its way away from the body, would be very, very detrimental to the whole experience. So let's look again from the Jerusalem Talmud, text number 3. Go ahead, Joe.
For 3 days, the soul hovers above the body, thinking that we can return to it. After 3 days, when it sees that the body's face has changed, it leaves the body and departs.
So unlike what we think that naturally, and it's funny because when you talk to children about death, we always say right away, you know, the soul went to Shemayim, the soul went to heaven, which is okay if you're talking to a child. But the truth is, it doesn't. The soul doesn't want to leave the body. And for 3 days, until it starts seeing the body change, right, it doesn't want to leave. And it remains, it wants to remain attached to the body. So as long as the body's intact, the soul's not, again, we're talking here about the nefesh. The nefesh doesn't want to leave. And so, during that interim period, as the body decomposes, the soul is somewhat displaced. It doesn't have a place in the body. It doesn't want to go to paradise. It just, like you said, you actually use the proper word. It hovers. It's hanging around near the grave. It doesn't know where to go.
Wait, what's the thing about, like, your soul is stuck until your body is completely decomposed?
We're going to talk about that. Well, decomposing is not the, you know, the maximum. That's why we have a whole process with 3 days, 7 days, 30 days, a year. We're going to talk about that right now. Go ahead, Linda.
I was just going to ask you, within 24 hours, the body is in the hands of the Chevra Kadisha?
Within minutes, it's in the hands of Chevra Kadisha.
And then, is it moved? Is it, because I've heard that it's important not to disturb the body or position of the body.
Body's very, very, it's moved very, very little. When a person passes away, just for those that are not familiar with it, it's not the topic of tonight's class, but based on the timeline, I think we'll be okay to share it. When a Jewish person passes away, we try to get the body buried ASAP. Just to give you some reference, my mother died at about 10 to 8 in the morning, on a Tuesday morning. Okay? A very good friend of mine from Bozeman called me the next morning to ask me when the funeral was. And I remember standing in my mother's living room laughing. I was already way into the first day of sitting Shiva. She died 8 to 10 in the morning. The funeral, she was already finished. The body was purified by the Chevra Kadisha, by the Holy Society, and already began the funeral process by 12:45. By 3 p.m. she was buried underground. The burial process was done by 3 p.m. So we do, and that's in New York. In Israel, it happens even quicker. They don't want, bodies are impure after they pass away. You don't want them just sitting around Jerusalem, so you want to get them buried ASAP. And so the burial process is very quick. What happens during that process? There's the Chevra Kadisha, the Holy Society. They purify the body. If there's a mikveh, they immerse the body in a mikveh. There's men Chevra Kadisha for the men. There's women for the women. If there's no mikveh that's available for bodies, you don't use a regular mikveh. You use a mikveh that's made for bodies after they pass away. Then you use other forms of water purification. But the bottom line is, we don't move the body. When the person passes away, you wait about, and don't hold me accountable on this number, but I think it's about 20 minutes before you unplug all the machines, because you want to make sure that it's real. And then you close the eyes of the person that passed away, and then you don't move the body. You don't touch the body, you don't move the body. The Chevra Kadisha comes in, and they take the body in the most respectful and honorable way. So, now that we got that out of the way, I want you to take a look at text 4a. Joe, are we up to you, or you said already?
I already did.
Okay, go ahead, Penn.
For 7 days, the soul goes from the house where it lived to the grave, and from the grave back to the house, and mourns its body. After 7 days, the body is subjected to that which it is subjected, and the soul ascends to its place.
So now, for the Shiva, during the 7 days, the soul now, the body is somewhat, the form, the way it looks has changed a little. So now it gets all lost, the soul, and it starts schlepping back and forth from the house of the deceased to the cemetery. Again, it's not a physical thing, it's the soul. It's confused, it's looking, it's searching, it's yearning. And after 7 days is when the soul starts its process of cleansing. That's what he means when he says the subjected to what it has to be subjected, the various cleansing experiences for the soul, and that's when the soul ascends to its place. Now let's look at 4b, a continuation. Go ahead, I just want to do 4b. Go ahead. Yeah, Jennifer, go ahead.
30 days, the soul and the body are judged as one, and thus the soul is found below. After that, the soul departs and the body arose in the earth.
And then, Suzanne, just read 4c.
For 12 months, the body still exists and the soul ascends and descends. After 12 months, the body becomes null and the soul rises and does not return.
And so we clearly have a 4-stage process of how the soul leaves the body. Yes, the minute a person passes away, the ruach gets separated, but the life force that was connected to that body its entire life, there's a 3-day experience, there's a 7-day experience, there's a 30-day experience, there's a year experience, and it's just fascinating that when we read about all these experiences of the soul, how it relates to the body, we're not even talking about how we relate to those timelines. But the truth is that in halacha and Jewish law, there are laws that happen to be associated with each one of these timelines of how we are to respond to what's going on with the soul.
So, Rabbi, is the soul alone during this time period?
Versus?
In contact with some other soul?
Yeah, it's alone. I mean, not alone. It's hovering with the body and connecting with those that want to have a connection with it. But in a sense, we're going to get to it soon, but in a sense, the soul is mourning too. We make a big mistake when we think that, you know, we are mourning, but the soul is in a better place. It's true. Eventually, the soul does end up in a pretty decent place. We call paradise for a reason. But the idea that during the period of mourning it's just about us, no. It's very much, it's also about us, but it's very much about the soul for which we are mourning, who is mourning himself. But we'll talk about that, and it's a very fascinating thing about Shiva, about sitting, you know, we mourn for 7 days, which is why it's called Shiva. There's something very fascinating about Shiva that's associated with the soul's mourning, which we'll get to soon. Go ahead, Ben.
So, when the soul is going from the grave back to the house, what if the house is a really long way away?
It's a soul. Again, we're not talking here necessarily, but we think of it in physical terms. It's coming from here to there. It's experiencing an internal struggle of connecting with the body that's now interred in the ground and connecting with the experience that it experienced in this world. In other words, it's not ready to let loose. It's not ready to let go of everything that it experienced. You know, and so I always go back to it, and I apologize if you guys get bored of it, but I can't help myself because there are shepherds of other faiths who immediately after someone dies says, oh, they're in a better place. Are you kidding me? Number one, how do you know? Have you ever been there? How do you know it's a better place? But even assuming that you're Jewish and you study the mystical teachings and you know it's a better place, it doesn't go there in 5 seconds. There's a process. And during that process, as much as we're grieving, the soul is grieving as well. Was there any other? Go ahead, Stan.
Yeah. What about the oddity of when the body is no longer present? You know, the cases where there is no body that remains.
We're going to get to that soon.
Okay.
We're going to touch on that whole thing and as it relates to things like cremation as well. But let's assume for a moment you're not talking about cremation. You're talking about, God forbid, a house fire or a car accident or a plane like just went out of the sky, 2 weeks ago? It's a good question. One thing I'll tell you off the bat without even having to go there is that it's way more painful for the soul than a normal passing and burial. There's no question about it.
And so the soul is always always has difficulty separating from the body, even if the body's been through like horrible cancer or something?
Sure. Sure. No, it's not missing the cancer. But no, you know, the only time your question would be a good one, and I don't know that I do know, I wouldn't have the answer to it, would be in a case where a person from the minute they were born to the minute they died, it was all a life of suffering. In other words, they were born with an ailment that they suffered their entire life, literally the entire life. So then I could understand the question is, what is it referring to? What is it missing about that bodily experience? But most people, even people that suffered with cancer, had a period in their life, or even within the time when they were going through the cancer, had moments where they were experiencing goodness and kindness, and it's that part of the body that has become so attached to the soul that the soul misses it. It's become part of their identity. And so, did you want to have that relationship in the first place? I don't know, but it happened, and now it happened, and now I can't let go because I experienced so much of what it was meant. You know, my experience is part and parcel with that body. Go ahead.
Is this the purgatory that exists in Judaism?
No, the fact that the soul is struggling.
That it's an in between place. It's not here, it's not there, it goes back, it goes forth, it's not confused, but...
No, because purgatory... Because purgatory, which I believe is going to be touched upon in another one of the classes, purgatory is about the soul itself. Purgatory, all these punishments that we talk about in mysticism about...
Not a punishment.
No, I'm saying, well, purgatory is a kind of a punishment. Let's not fluff it up too much. It is. You're purging the soul, which is a very painful thing for the soul. But it's not in relation to the soul and body. It's for the soul on its own. This is just relating to the fact that the soul's departure has to go through a separation anxiety of some level. And it's not an easy thing for the soul. And because it happens in stages, it's amazing how we as Jews don't always pay attention to the detail. Right? What are Jews busy with during Shiva? Let's face it. Shiva platters. We're busy sending platters of food. Which is nice. You sit in Shiva, the caterer sends a platter. Wonderful. That's not what Shiva's about. What is Shiva about? Look at text number 5. Go ahead, Linda.
3 days for weeping, 7 days for eulogies, and 30 days for observing the restrictions on haircuts and the other 5 matters.
Yeah, like going to special simchas, going on business, wearing fresh clothing. There's a whole list of things the way we mourn. In America today, someone dies, God forbid they should actually render their garments the way halacha says. They put a black ribbon and a symbolic. And every time I do a funeral in Montana, my rule number one, you want me to do the funeral? We're doing it the Jewish way. Which is get some shirt or jacket on, and we're going to rip it. That's what we do. We rip it so it should feel bad. And putting a ribbon on it doesn't make anyone feel bad. But my point is that there's a pro. 3 days, the first 3 days of Shiva, most people are not even supposed to come. It's supposed to be for close family and friends. Random acquaintances and neighbors from down the block who you really don't know shouldn't be showing up the first 3 days of Shiva because that's a time for weeping. You're not even able to grasp what just transpired. Then the rest of Shiva, the final 4 days, is for eulogy. Then you want people to come and share a story and share something nice and talk about it. You're up to talking a little bit more. Then there's the 30 days of... It's called Shloishim. We make a big memorial during Shloishim. If you guys remember when my mother passed away, I was scared to go to Shloishim because they were expecting a massive storm in New York and I was scared I'd be stuck there. And so I was actually... I canceled my ticket that morning and I was supposed to speak on behalf of my family and they did it via Skype. I didn't go. But Shloishim is a very big deal, the 30-day memorial. And then you have the 1 year, the first Yahrzeit, which is the first year of mourning. First year of mourning, you're not supposed to buy any new clothing. You're not supposed to attend, unless it's very close, like a sibling. You're not supposed to attend weddings and bar mitzvahs and celebrations. It's a year of mourning. The first 3 months you don't take haircuts. There's all these processes of what we do, but it's not only random acts that we do to show that we are mourning. They actually correlate exactly with what's going on with the soul at that particular time. And so, it's not only we're mourning for the deceased, we are mourning with the deceased. Because the deceased are mourning themselves because of this transition. And this brings me to this fascinating quote from the Talmud. To me, it's perhaps the most fascinating quote of tonight's class. Text number 6. Go ahead, Frank.
A person dies and leaves no next of kin to be comforted. 10 people go and sit in his home. A man died in Rabbi Yehuda's neighborhood. As there were no mourners to be comforted, Rabbi Yehuda assembled 10 people every day, and they sat in the deceased's home. After 7 days, the dead man appeared to Rabbi Yehuda in a dream and said, "Let your mind be at rest, for you have set my mind at rest."
So there was no one there to sit Shiva. So Rabbi Yehuda took a minyan and went and sat Shiva. Why? Because there's a soul that needs someone. The soul is waiting to see that someone actually cares about the fact that it's going through what it's going through. The idea that just because they didn't have any children in that particular case, and there was no, or God forbid, even the worst cases where there was no one left that was alive to sit Shiva. Therefore what? No one should sit Shiva? No one should be there to comfort the soul, to show the soul that we sort of understand or we get what you're going through? That's crazy. And so the entire process that we talk about when we talk about mourning is very much associated not only with our feelings. No one's taking away our feelings. Our feelings are very much part of it. But it has a lot to do with the soul as well. And if you think about it, as we continue in this journey, right? So the person passes away. The ruach separates from the body. There's two separate levels of the soul. You now had a burial. But before the burial, there's one other part of this puzzle that's a very big part of Judaism. It's called the levaya. The simple translation of the word levaya means to escort. It means the actual funeral procession. What is this business with a funeral procession? What are we following a body? Walking behind the body, carrying the casket. What is it all about? Let's take a look for a moment. Stana, text number 7a.
The one who is present at the time of a person's passing is required to tear his clothing. This is because a person's passing is likened to the burning of a Torah scroll.
Very, very powerful statement in the Talmud. What's the law when a Torah scroll is burned? It happens many times a year. God forbid the synagogue has a fire and the scroll and the ark. If today most people that build new synagogues build fireproof safes within the ark. It looks like it's wood from the outside, but inside is actually a steel, whatever, metal, steel, a fireproof safe. What happens if you're part of a community or you're standing outside a synagogue and you couldn't save the Torah and you watch the Torah scroll burn?
You bury it.
What do you have to do the first thing? You rip your clothing. Like a mourner, you have to rip your clothing. When someone passes away, what's the first thing you do before the funeral? Your clothing is ripped. What is the comparison here between a Torah scroll that's being burned and a person that's dying? What's the comparison?
Life. The tearing of the soul from the body, or
what? I want to know what would be the similarity with the Torah?
God. No.
Other than that, they're both holy. We know that a body is holy and a Torah is holy. That obviously has to be a better comparison. What's from us?
The Torah is taken from us.
Okay, so the Torah is taken from us and the person that's deceased is taken from us. But, you know, by a Torah scroll, anyone that's standing there rips his clothing. What's the case when, let's say you happen to be in a hospital visiting a friend, and while you're standing there, they die right in front of you. You have to rip your clothing. Because normally, when you speak to an average observant Jew, you say, when do you rip your clothing? When your parent, when someone that's very close to you passes away, or if your teacher, Torah teacher, passes away. It's not a very common thing. Here he's saying that if you happen to be in the room when someone passes away, you are part of that grieving experience, and you need to rip your clothing, just like if you saw Torah in your presence or in your community be burned. What's the comparison?
You're not asking us why we rip clothing.
Why rip clothing is a sign of mourning. It's a sign of sadness. We physically have just lost. when my mother died, I didn't have a suit for an entire year. Because I only owned one suit, and that was a suit that I ripped for the funeral, and that was it. For the rest of the year, I remember going to the governor's mansion, or the capital for menorah lighting. I put a black, I put some clothes together. I did not have a suit. And I couldn't buy one. Mourning is mourning. You don't break the rules of mourning.
7B.
Of course 7B.
Yeah.
Shocking that it's in 7B, the answer. Go ahead, Joe. I think we're up to you. Stani, you just read, right? Yeah, go ahead, Joe. 7B. Nachmanides.
Yeah, we're here, though. Nachmanides of blessed memory explains that the soul in the body is like the names of God inscribed on the parchment of the Torah scroll.
So you have the letters of God's name on the parchment. So there's the physical, there's the body of the Torah, and the soul of the Torah. The parchment, the physicality, push. The parchment is the body. The letters that include many, many times God's name, the holy words of the Torah, they are the soul of the Torah. And when a fire burns it, God forbid, you've now separated the body and the soul and now separated from each other. And that's a thing that needs to be mourned. Not only because of our feelings about it, but because of the poor Torah that now is non-existent anymore. When a person passes away, the body and soul, like the parchment and the letters, and now they're being separated, that is another state of mourning. But it also teaches us something very powerful about a body. And this is something that unfortunately many in the non-observant Jewish world, so whether it's a secular Jew, a secular Christian, the only ones that I think come even close to observing it the way we do are perhaps Muslims. And that is, how do we treat a body? You know, you watch, for those of you that watch TV and a little bit I know about it, you know, there's shows about hospitals, Grey's Anatomy, and they have a certain way they portray the way bodies are dealt with. It looks like a body factory. Okay, we lost one, another one's coming, and you know, it's very rare, and even with all the emotion involved, it's very rare that anyone actually focuses on the fact that a body has a level of holiness as the permanent, not permanent, but the lifelong partner of the soul. It has a holiness to it that must not be desecrated. Look at text number 8. Go ahead, Ben.
All who handle the dead must be aware that they are involved with a holy entity. The human body is not only the container that served the exalted soul, but has itself become sanctified with an independent holiness similar to a Torah scroll.
So when a person passes away, we treat the body with utmost dignity. You don't have, even when the Chevra Kaddish are doing their work, there's no casual conversations going on in the room in the presence of the deceased body. At all times, the deceased body is covered. Unless the part, even when you're purifying the body, their private parts are kept covered until the moment that you actually have to purify it, and then it's immediately covered again.
But it's more holy when the soul is with it, though, right?
Sure, but when the soul is with the body, the person that's living with that body and soul, they're the ones that are in charge of maintaining its holiness. When they pass away, they're not capable of maintaining its holiness, so it becomes the communal obligation to ensure that the person is buried properly, which brings to an interesting point. There are many, many Jewish people that I don't want to say the word live, because they're not really alive, but their final day in this world is more holy sometimes than their entire life. Because they lived a life however they lived. And they were in control of it, and they maybe chose not to live a life of sanctity and holiness. But the last day of theirs on earth, they're being purified in a mikvah, they're being buried by Jewish law, they're fulfilling biblical commandments of how they should be buried. They died as a Jew more than they lived as a Jew. Which is a sad state of affairs. I'm not supporting it, I'm not condoning it, I'm just saying it's a reality. One should always live as a Jew. It's much more exciting than dying as a Jew. But the reality is that point is well taken, is that we treat it with the utmost holiness and proper, you know, not to allow the body in any way. We never turn the body face down. I mean, there's a lot of rules of how not to desecrate the body. Furthermore, there's something very interesting in Jewish law. Some of you remember back when Barbara Schneider passed away here in the community, Edith's mom, a couple years ago. She passed away at late Shabbos afternoon, and right after Shabbos we ran over there, and three women from the Jewish community helped take the body to Dahl Funeral Home. And the entire night, till the morning, when the hearse took the body to Billings to fly to New Jersey for burial, the entire night from Saturday night to Sunday morning, we had shifts at Dahl Funeral Home, where various people in the community sat for 2-hour shifts saying psalms. Now let me tell you, I'll be the first to admit it, maybe some of the other macho men won't. Sitting at 2 a.m. alone in Dahl Funeral Home with bodies is not so exciting, to say the least. However, it's a beautiful thing we do for anybody, and it's called a shomer u'shomeres, a guardian. We guard the body, we say psalms, but even if you're not saying psalms, I told this to the guys then, I said, it doesn't matter, if you can't say psalms, don't say psalms. But the body should never for a moment feel like it's being abandoned, because the soul still has recognition of what's transpiring in this world, which is why we escort the body to burial, because it feels, it knows if everyone just abandoned it. It's the saddest thing in the world when you hear about a mes mitzvah. What's a mes mitzvah? A burial, a deceased mitzvah. What's a deceased mitzvah? When someone dies and leaves no family, and there's no one there to take care of the burial. The community comes together. It says that even a kohen gadol, even the high priest, becomes impure if there's a dead person on the side of the road and there's no one there to deal with him. So, it's not only an emotional thing, oh, we feel so bad because this person has no next of kin. It's an neshama. There's a soul there that's suffering. And if we step up to the plate to actually bring them the comfort, to show that we are there, it's not only about our goody-goody feeling, it's about actually giving the soul the comfort that it's yearning. Look at text number 9. Go ahead, I think we're up to you, Jennifer.
We maintain a watch over the dead out of respect. For if we were to leave the body alone, it would appear as if we abandoned it like a utensil that we no longer desire.
So we don't abandon the body. And sometimes, there's certain rulings, like when children live in Australia, for example, and the parent is in New York, there are times that certain, depending on the situation, the rabbis will allow the burial to happen a day and a half later. Not much longer, but because they're waiting for the children to come. And so, in Israel, they don't allow it. In Israel, there's no such thing. They don't wait for anyone. But in the United States, outside of Israel, they do. Sometimes. And so sometimes for a day and a half. There's people doing shmirah, people watching over the body, being the guardianship of the, you know, being the guardian of the body. But then there's another detail. You know, God forbid when there's these big, especially when we used to have the, may it never come back again, when we used to have the terrible suicide bombings on the buses in Israel. Now they figured out a new trick with stabbings, so that's not as relevant. But when the suicide bombings, you would have sometimes 30 bodies splattered all over the street, sometimes a mile away. And you would see an organization, you still see them, Zaka. And they go and they scrape up every body part, every drop of blood. What are they collecting it for? Here in America, when there's an accident on the highway and there's blood on the... They bring some water, they wash it up, and they clean up the road. They don't collect the blood from the highway, from the 90. Why in Israel are they busy collecting it? In America, there's an organization that does it too. It's called Misaskim. But why are they doing that? Why are they collecting body parts? Every fingernail, every ounce of blood. What's the point? It's gruesome.
To bring the completeness of the body together.
Look at text number 10. Very good. Go ahead, Suzanne.
Just as there is no difference between a complete Torah scroll and one letter from the Torah scroll, as both must be treated with utmost respect, it is forbidden to accord disrespect to even a single bone from sacred bodies that were created in God's image.
And so we try to get everything. There's a whole discussion in Jewish law about an amputated body part that was amputated before the person passed away. Halacha says at the end that you should bury it. The question is, do you wait until the person passes away or not? But either way, but if it's during the time of passing, if God forbid there's a situation, you take every part of it, because again, like Stana said, we're talking here about an image of God. And who are we to decide that this part doesn't deserve to be buried, this part doesn't need to be with the soul? The more of the body that's with the soul at the time of burial, the less painful it is, which goes back to your point, when there's no body, it's extremely painful for the soul. It's extremely painful for the soul in a way that we try very hard not to even, let's just say, God's ways are mysterious. And I just recommend that we don't try to figure out why a person deserved that or didn't deserve that type of ending in their life, because that's up to God, not to us. We shouldn't be the ones judging. But let's just say that for the soul, it's a very, very tough experience. You know, when we talk about burials, just because the class is a little bit too much, you know, it's about death, it's about passing. You know, they say about a rabbi that went to the synagogue and discovered a dead mule in the front yard. So he called the police. They didn't show up because it wasn't foul play. The police told him, they referred him to go to the health department. They called the health department. They said there was no health threat, so they should call the sanitation department. So they called the sanitation department, and he didn't. He can't pick up the mule without authorization from the mayor. So this poor rabbi called the mayor. But immediately the mayor started screaming at him, "Why did you call me anyway? Isn't it your job, Rabbi, to bury the dead?" So the rabbi tells the mayor, "Yes, mayor, it is my job to bury the dead, but I always like to notify the next in kin first." And you know, when we talk about burial, this becomes a very touchy subject, and I'd like to preface it by saying that this, what I'm about to share, is not about beating yourselves up about previous things that were done either before you had this knowledge or with someone that didn't have the knowledge or had the knowledge or didn't care. It's not about the past. It's about how we deal from today on. And from today onward, we have to know the truth of what Judaism thinks about burial. Let's look at text number 11. Linda, it's you. Go ahead.
Man goes to his everlasting home, and the mourners go about in the street. And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it.
We don't own our bodies. We are given bodies as a custodian of the body. We are the custodians of the body. Eventually, a custodian needs to give back the product that was given to them. God takes the soul, but the body needs to be returned from where it came. Where did it come from? When God created the first human being, which was Adam, He created him from the earth. And so when the body, it's time for the body to finish its mission in this world, you put it back where it came from, in the earth. Look at text number 12. Go ahead, Frank.
"For dust you are, and to dust you will return. Man's body comes from the earth and is left with him as a deposit. Upon death, the deposit must be returned to the earth from where it came."
Burial is fundamental in Judaism, not only because of the sacredness and the body and not to desecrate it. It's vital because it's returning it to where it came from. You know, I always wonder why in America today there's this whole business of "it's my body, and as long as I'm not hurting anyone, it's my body. Baloney. First of all, it's not yours. Second of all, if it was really yours, then I want someone to explain to me why when someone tries to jump off the San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge, there's SWAT teams and boats and helicopters. Why do you care? He's hurting anybody by jumping off the bridge? Why don't you let him jump? It's his body. But yet, Mekum Tzolofim, everyone comes running to save the guy. What are you saving him for? What happened to his personal space? Judaism does not believe that our bodies belong to us. Not a man, not a woman, not an adult, not a child. The body's not ours. It was given to us on loan from God to utilize while our souls in this world and utilize that partnership. And now that it's done, it's not yours to choose what you want to do with the body. I'm very happy that you wanted to choose to do X, Y, and Z. It's not your choice. You got to follow the manual that the programmer, that the creator gave for the body, which is to bury it. If you look at Jewish history, not only Jewish history, but the first human being. What was the first person that died in the Bible? The first human being to die. Who was that?
Abel.
Cain killed Abel. The first death was a murder. They didn't know what to do. Adam was sitting there crying over the body of his deceased son Abel and had no idea what is he supposed to do with a dead body. And then he saw a raven, a bird, burying another bird who had died. And he said, I guess that's what we do. We put him underground. And so he buried him. That was the first burial. Sarah, last week's Torah portion, Abraham goes and for a hefty price purchases a burial spot in the city of Hebron, to bury his wife Sarah. Then Abraham is buried there. Who buried Abraham near Sarah? His two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. They both came together to bury their father. Rachel's buried by Jacob in Bethlehem. We read about it in the Torah. Jacob is taken to be buried in Israel by his son Joseph. While he was viceroy, he went to Israel and then came back. And Joseph himself, when he died, he said, when you guys leave this country of Egypt, I want you to take my body. And many, many years later, Joseph's body is carried out of Egypt by Moses and eventually buried in the city of Nablus and the city of Shechem. And when Moses died, God gets involved in the burial himself. The idea of burying a body is not a novel idea that's somewhere deep in mysticism. As you travel through the Torah, we recognize that burial is part and parcel of Jewish practice. Furthermore, if you study the books of the prophets, we know there was a famous woman named Ruth. Who was Ruth? Ruth was a woman, a Moabite. And she and another woman named Orpah married two sons that were sons of a woman named Naomi. And Naomi's sons died because they sinned, and Naomi said, that's it, I'm going back to Israel. And when she goes back to Israel, Orpah and Ruth follow her. They want to go with her. They want to go with their former mother-in-law. And she said, what are you guys, crazy? Go back to Moab. Go live your life. Don't come with me. Don't become Jewish. We have enough. Trust me, you don't want to be Jewish. We have a lot of trouble. Orpah, one of them, says, you're right. You know what? And she goes back. Ruth says, no way, I'm coming. What does Ruth tell Naomi when she says, I'm not going anywhere? Stana, text number 13, go ahead. A very powerful statement.
Ruth responded, do not press me to leave you, to return to Moab rather than follow you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried.
So one of the wherever you die, I will die. Wherever you be buried, she was making a statement about her conversion to Judaism. Ruth converted to Judaism. And she was saying that I recognize that part of Judaism, a fundamental principle in Judaism, is burial. And I want to be buried like a Jew, just like you, my mother-in-law, Naomi. Eventually, Ruth marries Boaz, and they eventually are the great-grandparents of King David. And so the whole Davidic dynasty started from this woman, Ruth. Kever Yisrael, a Jewish burial, has always been something Jews have fought for. The Israeli army goes into enemy territory. Most times we don't even know about it, but they go into enemy territory to retrieve a body. I'm not talking about a body that's 50 feet away and, you know, the Marines go in and take it to get the body. I'm talking about going in to countries that are the furthest thing from our friends and hundreds, if not thousands of miles away from their homeland of Israel to retrieve a body. We've given up thousands, in my opinion, wrongfully so, but we've given away thousands of terrorists. We've let them out of prison to get one body back. But we take a Jewish burial very, very serious. Where does it come from? Look at the book of Deuteronomy. The fifth book of the five books of Moses, go ahead, Josh. Very long verse, go ahead, 14.
You shall surely bury him on the same day.
So over there it's talking about particularly about a body that was hung. And so you don't let it hang. Even if a person is put to death by hanging, you immediately take it off and bury it. You don't leave it hanging there. You know, in other traditions, they leave it there as a sign. Everyone should know what this person did. Judaism, we don't. But it's very, very unfortunate that in America today, they say, the National Funeral Directors Association says that 46.7% of Americans that died are cremated and were cremated in 2014. That's almost 50%. In 1960, how many percent of America do you think was cremated? 3.5. So in 50 years, we've jumped almost 45%. And they're predicting that by 2050 or whatever it is, or 2030, it'll be up to 70%. And as Jews, we need to stand strong and say, just like with everything else in Jewish life, you know, it's not about what the winds, where the winds blow, and that's what we do. We do what's right. They have a whole concoction telling us that it's good. It's not good for the environment to bury bodies. It's much better to cremate them. In truth, the research just came out that cremation is way worse for the environment. And not that that's the reason, but I want you just to know that. That the carcinogens that come out of the cremations are way worse for the environment than any type of burial. But again, it's not even about that. It's about the mere fact that our bodies belong to God, not to us. And if God told us to bury it, we buried, even if our personal feelings are that it shouldn't be. Another big reason, and that I'll be honest with, it is a big issue, and that is, it's very expensive. To get a Jewish burial spot is not cheap. Jewish cemeteries make a lot of money. But that should never be a reason. Because if God forbid someone died and they couldn't afford a burial spot, the Jewish community would get them a burial spot. There's no such thing. I've yet to hear in my almost 34 years on this world that a Jewish person died and couldn't get a burial spot. We find it for them. Because it's not even a Jewish thing. Every body that every person that passes away needs to be buried. Cain and Abel weren't Jewish. And yet it was important to bury Abel. And so this idea of, again, I don't think it's worthy of us making billboards and if we're going to inspire the world, you probably want to inspire people about things that they do while they're alive, and then there's a good chance that they'll be inspired to die properly as well. So you don't make campaigns about death programs. But for ourselves, we need to know that no matter what your plans have been until now, the right thing to do as a proper custodian of the body that God gave us is to be buried properly. Not to follow the trends, whatever the reason is that you may buy into it, it's not a good enough reason to mess with the body that God gave us. Now, what about people that didn't have the choice? People that didn't have a choice didn't have a choice, but the body's not ours, and that's why you know, there's this concept in Judaism about the resurrection of the dead. Resurrection of the dead is one of the 13 principles that Maimonides teaches of Jewish faith, and that when the Messiah comes, when Moshiach comes, somewhere in that process, there'll be the resurrection, the bodies and souls will come back to life. But if there's no body, you sort of created a big problem. It's not a short-term problem. There is no body now. The body has been cremated. There's nothing there. And it's a statement that we're making. We make a statement that the idea that there'll be a resurrection of the dead is something I don't care about. The minute you choose to be cremated, you're making a statement that you don't really care about those principles. And that's a very harsh statement to make. And so we have to be very careful about the direction we go with this. But now comes the question that everyone always asks me. I'm always lucky to get these questions. But my mother wrote in her will she wants to be cremated. What am I supposed to do? I'm not supposed to follow what she said? What do you do? You're sitting here at the class tonight. You heard that cremation is not an appropriate way to go. But in the will it says clearly that's what they want.
Well, typically, you would just ignore what they said, right?
Well, let's take a look. 15a and 15b, who are we up to?
Me.
Go ahead, read both.
It's a mitzvah to uphold the wishes of the dead, or the deceased. Excuse me. 15b, if a person requested not to be buried, we disregard the request. This is because burial is a mitzvah, as it says, you shall surely bury him.
Let me say, let's say you died, and in your will you wrote that after I die, I'd like you to go to my neighbor's house and burn it down. Right? That's what they wrote in the will. The will says that when I die, go next door and burn the neighbor's house down. Are you going to do that? Why not? Why not? Very simple reason. It doesn't belong to you. It's not your house to burn down.
So the body is...
Correct. And so now taking that to the body, the body's not the person who died. It's very nice that he told you to cremate or she told you to cremate it, but do they really have the power to say that? I understand that legally they do. I'm not arguing the legalities of it. We have a lawyer in the room. I would never dare do that. But obviously legally you can't disobey them or you can't claim that it's legal to do. But they don't have a right from a Jewish perspective over their body, and so they have no right to tell you to be an accomplice in getting something like that done to the body. Go ahead.
If you don't have time now, maybe at some other time, but can you touch upon people who take their own life?
In what regard?
In any regard.
I'm just trying to figure out where it fits into this particular...
Suicide.
Did they get buried in a Jewish cemetery?
I understand they don't.
These days they do. There's a section in the cemetery where they would bury someone like that at the far end of the cemetery. Suicide is considered one of the harshest... Bless you. Suicide is considered one of the harshest things that a person can do. Although we're not necessarily judging them for what they've done because we're not in that place. But from a halachic standpoint, from a Jewish standpoint, it's akin to a murder. I mean, we always come, when someone's a murderer, we treat them as such. You know, they murdered someone, they took a life. Here, although you may be murdering yourself, which is obviously a very different scenario, but in essence, if you actually get to the essence of it, there's no difference. They took a life. In this case, they took their own life, which again, they had no right to do, going back to everything we just said. Now, obviously, we have to recognize that if someone reached such a point, right? There's a very big difference. In halacha, the term for suicide is ha'ma'abed atzmo ladas, which is he loses himself by choice, by with his own knowledge. Most people that commit suicide in the world we live in today are not doing it with knowledge. They're actually reaching a place of mental instability to be able to do that. Very rarely, and there exists, but very rarely is it a case where a person deliberately decides, you know, let's give an example, that the world is overpopulated and I'm taking up too much space and so I'm deliberately going to kill myself. That's not normally the case. When someone jumps off a roof, God forbid, it's because they've reached the point of no return, or they reach the point where they're just not there anymore. And so there's a whole debate whether that's actually considered, you know, is that what the Torah was talking about when it spoke about someone taking their own life deliberately? Is that actually considered deliberate? And so it happens. It happens in the Orthodox community, just like it happens everywhere else. And we do sit Shiva, and the burial is in a very, it's a very unassuming, quiet burial, but it's a very sad state of affairs. But there's no major writings in Judaism into the detail of it. I mean, the Rachmanis, you know, the Talmud says something very interesting. The Talmud says, "Shoyt the asal arachim olav," that a stupid person, you're not supposed to have pity on them. If someone's an idiot, you shouldn't have pity on them. So in Hasidic teaching, it says, "Usser." When you say the word "usser," it can either mean prohibited, or it can mean you're bound to. Asur, like someone that's in a beta asurim, in a house of prison, it's called a place that you're bound up in. So Chassidus says, the Rebbe Marash, the fourth Chabad Rebbe, said, if someone's an idiot, you're that's the first guy you should have pity on. Because he doesn't even know that it's a Rachmanas on him. He doesn't even know that it's a pity on him. Who else are you going to have? Who's a bigger pity? Who's the best person to have pity on is someone that doesn't even know that there's something to be pitiful? There's something pitiful about them. And so when you're talking about suicide, it's a... And here in Montana, unfortunately, I was just speaking to someone on the phone about it today. Here in Montana, mental health is a very real issue. And suicide is at a rate that doesn't make any sense. I don't know what it is about. I really don't. We live in a beautiful place. And yet the suicide rate is insane. If the suicide rate was like that in New York, I'd understand. But in Montana, it doesn't make any sense. But it's something very real. And we need to be very, very careful. Even as, obviously, rabbis. But not only rabbis. Even friends and family. If we ever encounter a situation of suicide, we need to be very, very careful what we say.
You mean a person who's suicidal?
No. That I recommend you get professional. But dealing with people that have lost someone to suicide, very, very careful what we say, because they are very, very, more than your average person. They're obviously very, very sensitive, and you may mean the world in what you're saying to them. And in this case, it's where the Talmud says, "Sevla chacham shtika," you're much better off remaining silent. Just be there for them physically. Don't say. Don't talk very little, because there's not much you can say. We may touch on it later classes. That's just a little bit of the idea of where Judaism goes with them. So this idea that the body doesn't belong to us. For example, you're not allowed to testify, Jennifer, in American law, in our judicial system, are you allowed to self-incriminate yourself?
Are you allowed to?
If you admit to a murder, would that be admissible in court? If you admit to a murder, would that be admissible in court?
Well, it would have to be corroborating evidence.
I understand, but would the admission count as something in court?
Yeah, absolutely.
In Jewish law, it wouldn't. You can't incriminate yourself. You're not allowed to hurt yourself. There's a lot of laws in Judaism about hurting yourself, whether it's bodily or emotionally. You're not allowed to do things that hurt yourself. You're not allowed to harm yourself. You can't. When I say you can't incriminate yourself, I'm not talking about financially. I'm talking about where it's a capital case where you can be executed. Your incrimination is worthless.
Even if you've taken the life of another.
Specifically, if you're taking the life of another, because that's the only time, it's one of the only times you'd actually be executed. In biblical times, you'd be executed, not by, if there are two witnesses, there's a program, and you could be put to death, but not by your own admission. Because again, we don't allow someone to hurt themselves. So, we have to get that out of our mind, and I know it's not easy, especially in the Facebook world we live in. We have to take it out of our mind, as hard as it is, that our bodies are not autonomous. We don't own them. It's not our personal autonomy that we can do whatever we want with it. It was given to us as a gift. And as long as we follow the instructions of what to do with the gift, then we are living the way we are supposed to live. Which brings us right to another example. Look at text 16. Something that some of you may or may not know. I don't even know who we're up to. But I guess, yeah, go ahead, Jennifer.
Do not place a tattoo on your bodies.
It's a biblical prohibition. No tattoos. Why not? What's wrong with a tattoo?
You're defacing your body.
We'll go back to the same thing. You know, there's a myth out there that says that if someone has a tattoo, they can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery.
Isn't that true?
It's a baba maisa.
It's a baba maisa.
Not only can a person with a tattoo be buried in a Jewish cemetery, but you don't even have to remove the tattoo before burial. They can be buried with the tattoo. So you ask the question, then where did the myth come from? My guess is it came from this. And that is, a tattoo is all about not defacing the body. Burial is also about the fact that you don't have autonomy over your body and you have to be buried. So someone along the way made a concoction and decided that if you have a tattoo, you can't be buried. It's a myth. But my point of bringing this quote is that, why wouldn't you be allowed? You want to have a beautiful picture on your arm. Again, my point is not to discuss if you have a tattoo, what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to do anything. If you have it, you have it. There's tens of thousands of returnees of Bali Tshuva, of people that became closer to Judaism later in their life, and they had tattoos when they were younger, and they keep it. They don't get rid of it.
People probably made it like one of the stories that you tell kids, you know, so they don't do the wrong thing.
Yeah, whatever. Listen, I don't mind the myth, but it is a myth. And we have to call it for what it is. If a Jew has a tattoo, they can be buried in a Jewish cemetery.
They earned death as a young child.
But they can't.
But they cannot.
It's a total BS from beginning to end. It's okay, you're not... There's, I would say, I don't know, a big chunk of children growing up in Orthodox, you know, it's one of these myths that has managed to propagate itself for decades, at least decades, but it's not true. But it is prohibited to have a tattoo. Why? Because it's not your body to play with. Even piercings, there's a whole discussion. Women are allowed to have piercings because that was the custom, that women had piercings for beautification. They would put jewelry. But even that, we had once in a JLI course a few years ago, one of the medical ethics classes, we touched upon the idea of these insane piercings on your tongue, on here and there. That becomes that borders on, not borders, it becomes mutilation, and that's not beautification. Even if there's some people that think it's gothic or whatever, that's not beautification. It has to be the accepted norm throughout history. Earrings, nose ring, those were accepted norm, and the other ones are not. So, and you see today they have all these crazy piercings where half your earlobe is, I don't even know what they call it. It just hurts when I see it. But my point is, it's not your body to play with. It's not your body to mess with. And it's a silly idea where people, I don't know why they think that way, but they think for some reason that it's theirs, they own it.
Are there actually things that you can do to be disqualified from being buried in a Jewish cemetery? Or are they all just myths and don't apply anymore?
No, suicide is a real one, and depending on the cemetery, they either have a separate section, like I said, in a corner somewhere in the cemetery, or probably, my guess is there are certain cemeteries that have rules from back in the day that they wouldn't allow it at all. Someone that's an apostate, if someone converted publicly to another faith, and deliberately went against the Jewish faith, they would have probably a very hard time finding a place in a Jewish cemetery. So there are some cases, but it is definitely rare.
Is it true that that Sabbath observers and non-Sabbath observers have to be separated?
If there is such an idea, I've never seen it, because the Montefiore Cemetery, where the Rebbe is buried, where my mother's buried, where all my grandparents are buried, the ones that are that have passed, there's no separation. Now there are chelkas, it's called different communities own different areas, different plots, different sections, but there's no gate separating them, so they're all technically next to each other. And if there is such a thing, it's definitely not. And Montefiore is one of the biggest cemeteries in New York, Orthodox Jewish cemeteries in New York. So I would assume if there was such a thing, I would see something of the sort. Go ahead.
So how did Judaism rectify personal adornment, like things like sun tanning? You know, it's not good for the body to do that, the research shows, but people suntan. It's my body to suntan because I want to look better for someone else, or I want to look better for my own.
So that's a good question. I mean, that leads to a much bigger question. It's like, well, what about, what do they call it? The plastic surgery, you know, nose lifts all these physical, enhancements, which is a very big business. We had a whole JLI quite some time ago about this issue, and there's no definitive answer, but at the end of the day, most of these things are permitted if there's very, very minimal risk.
Oh, okay.
Because there's no desecration involved. Again, you have to be careful with the tattoo. You're literally changing the body the way, you know, the visual of what the body looks like from the way God gave it to us. When you talk about suntan lotion, it's not a permanent, it's a suntanning, it's not a permanent change. You're changing an appearance for X amount of time, and then it goes back, and then you can go do it again. You're not permanently changing the body, unlike a tattoo. The other body enhancements, like the surgeries and stuff, that becomes a much more problematic thing. And overall, even though it may be permitted, it's very, very highly unrecommended that we do anything of the sort. And so, it becomes, but that's a whole other, it's a good question because it relates to the idea of body autonomy, but it's way beyond the scope of this class. If you'd like, I don't know if we have anything we may have in the additional readings, otherwise after the, I could always send you a link where you can read more about how we relate to that.
Rabbi Chaim, what about medical surgeries? Say like a hip replacement, a knee replacement, where they actually take tissue, dispose of it. I mean, if you're supposed to be buried with your body parts, all kinds of
tissue. Listen, hip replacement today is considered for the health of the person.
Yeah.
You know, And so what they would do with tissue, I don't know, and it's a good question. But overall, there's nothing wrong if someone needs a hip replacement, there's no halakhic issue whatsoever. We're not of the mentality that says, oh well, it didn't exist 150 years ago, so we don't do it. On the contrary, if medicine is allowing a person to live longer, by all means, tap into it. But Stana's point about where do you draw the line between, you know, enhancing your well-being versus changing who you are the way God gave you to this world, that becomes a very fine line that needs to be addressed, but it's beyond the scope of tonight's class. I'd like to continue with text number 17. I think we're up to you, Suzanne.
The nephesh is present in the grave. It is among the living and is acquainted with their pain. At a time of need, it pleads for mercy for them. When the inhabitants of the world are in need, when they are in sorrow and they go to the cemetery, the nephesh is awakened. It flies up and arouses the ruach, which in turn entreats God for mercy. The Holy One, blessed be He, then has mercy on the world.
So here we find something very interesting. What's this business of visiting grave sites, you know, before Rosh Hashanah, before Yom Kippur, or when you're in the area? For example, when I go to New York, I try always, this last trip last week, just because of the schedule, I didn't have a chance, but normally when I'm in New York, I never miss a chance to go to my mother's gravesite. What is this business of standing by a gravesite and talking to the deceased? And, you know, I mean, it feels good, right? You sit and you talk and you feel like you're talking to your mother, your grandmother, your brother, whatever, your spouse. But what is it really about? So the Zohar tells us what it's about. The nephesh never leaves the burial place. That lowest level of the soul, which was the biological life force of the body, that's where it remains forever. That's it. It was the nephesh of that body. Wherever the body went into the grave, that's where the nephesh remains. And so for all eternity, whenever you want to bond with the soul of the person that you had a relationship with or want to have a relationship with, that is the port. It's a, you know, that's where you plug in to connect on high. It's an opportunity to plug in to connect on high via the soul that exists within that burial place.
So this type of connection is just unavailable to Kahana.
That's a very good point. A Kohen, a priest, is not allowed to go into a cemetery because they are of the priestly family. They're not allowed to come impure. So obviously they have a spiritual status which allows them to connect on high where they wouldn't need that type of experience in the cemetery. But it's a very good point that a Kohen doesn't have that opportunity, but we do. Although a Kohen, a priest, does have the opportunity of going to the gravesite of righteous people like tzaddikim. They do go. A Kohen and go to the Rebbe's resting place, or Shimon Bar Yochai, all the great sages they go to. So they have a connection, just not with the particular family members that they may want to go to. This idea that you connect and you have a port is not only while the body's there. Even after the body decomposes, that location where the body went into the ground is the place that, we don't know why, but we know that the mysticism, that the Zohar says that that's where the nefesh remains and that's where we connect. Which explains something very interesting. It's not okay to abandon a place that has a Jewish cemetery. You know, we always think, oh, there's no Jews left in town, so we're just going to close up shop and head out. What about the Jewish cemetery here in town? Oh, well, we hired the so-and-so. Jews mostly never left anywhere. We were always kicked out of places. We never left by choice. It's a very rare thing for a Jew to leave anywhere by choice. We were kicked out from here, so we went there. We were expelled from here, so we went there. So, of course, there's thousands of Jewish cemeteries all over that have been so-called, you know, they're maintained, but they've been abandoned by the actual community. But not by choice. By choice, you don't abandon. Why don't you abandon? Look at text number 18. Go ahead, Linda.
There was once a community that wished to uproot and move to a different location. One of the deceased of the community appeared in a dream to a member of the community and said, "Please do not leave us, for we take pleasure when you visit the cemetery." Barzillai HaGiladi said, "I would like to die in my own city." He said this because the dead are delighted when we, their loved ones, visit their grave sites and request goodness for their souls. This improves their condition in heaven. And when we make requests, the departed pray for us.
They like visitation. So we always think of grave site visit because it makes us feel good. That's true, it does. And that's one component of it. The other component of it is They want it. You just don't abandon. You want to be. You want to bury people near where there's a community where people will come and visit the gravesite.
Are you familiar with the idea of quantum entanglement?
Not at all. Should I?
I don't know. Maybe it's
impossible.
Okay. Oh, if Joe has to talk to me about it, that means that it's scientific and he lost me.
It's in many ways. It's very interesting. It's how things can remain connected forever, really, over theoretically infinite distances of space or time.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of the two things and a connection that they once had.
Interesting. Well, I'll get to hear from Joe about it. He'll give me a lecture. But the point is that, you know, we spend a lot of money sometimes. Grandchildren go back to Poland or Russia or Ukraine and they find, or Spain, and they find the burial places of other Jews, and they spend money to beautify it, not to make it fancy, but just to clean it up. Why? So that people can come and pray there. Why would people come and pray there? Because these souls have been waiting for visitors for who knows how many years, hundreds of years sometimes, thousands of years, and no one's visited. It's lonely for them. They want visitation. And when we come and we ask that soul to beseech God on our behalf, it gives them the greatest pleasure because now they're useful. They feel like they're connecting with us in a way that they can actually be useful. And so we're actually doing them a favor. And as we reach the final moments of tonight's class, I'd like to conclude with this letter that Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote in 1958. There's a woman in Crown Heights. She still lives in Crown Heights. Her name is Chana Sharfstein. She actually has a close relative here in Montana. Not in Bozeman. Some distance from Bozeman, but in Montana. In a span of 5 years, she lost her father, mother, and mother-in-law. In 5 years. And she was a young woman. And she wrote to the Rebbe a very emotional letter about her feelings, about all these losses that she had experienced. And this is an excerpt of what the Rebbe wrote back to her, penning a long letter in English, but this is excerpts of it. Go ahead, Frank, text number 19.
Blessing and greeting. I received your undated letters in which you write about your emotional upsets in connection with the passing of your mother and the questions which are troubling you in this connection, involving also questions in regard to the passing of your father. Peace unto them. Another fundamental point to remember, which has a direct bearing on your letter, is that all believers in God believe also in the survival of the soul. Actually, this principle has even been discovered in this physical world, where science now holds as an absolute truth that nothing in the physical world can be absolutely destroyed. How much more so in the spiritual world, especially in the case of the soul, which in no way can be affected by the death and disintegration of the physical body. It would be silly and illogical to assume that, because a certain organ of the body ceases to function, affecting other physical organs of the body, the spiritual soul would also be affected thereby. The truth is that when the physical body ceases to function, the soul continues its existence, not only as before, but even on a higher level, inasmuch as it is no longer handicapped by the restraints of the physical frame. Thirdly, the attachment of children to their parents and general attachment between close relatives during life on this earth is surely not a physical attachment by the respective physical bodies of the relatives. Essentially, the attachment is a spiritual one due to the spiritual affinity between those concerned and the qualities of the soul, including such spiritual things as character, kindness, goodness, etc., all of which are attributes of the soul and not of the body. Therefore, also, every action on the part of the person in relation to a beloved person and the desire to benefit that person is not directed towards pleasing his physical body, his bones and tissue, for it is the spiritual pleasure that he is concerned with. In view of the above, it is clear that even after the physical body has disintegrated and disappeared from view, it is still possible to bring joy and benefit to the soul, which, as noted above, not only survives, but does so on a higher level, and all the things which had previously brought joy and pleasure to one's parents will continue to do so even after they are physically no longer here.
Which I think speaks for itself, and it's worthwhile to keep that letter handy because you may need it either for yourself or someone that you care for.
I just would like to interject something. When I was a cantor for the other Shulam Tom, when it was the only acting Tom, all right, the last year that I decided I wasn't going to do it anymore was when the High Holy Days were there, and I was told I had to skip the Ma'adam section because, quote, we don't necessarily believe in life after death. Life after death is the progeny that your progeny that will carry on your life. It was Rabbi Sesher that told me that.
Listen, so, it's
I'm not making that up.
You know this,
so
for about
these Jewish people who die and then they get cremated and they don't even.
So if someone's cremated and they don't know any better, it's one thing. If they know better, then it's another whole story. But there's no question. I mean, the Reform movement took the resurrection of the dead prayer, which is the second blessing we say in the Amidah, every Amidah, Mechaya, Mason, they took it out of their Amidah 100 years ago.
And just
a few years ago, they put it back as an optional prayer because they stuck it on the bottom as an optional prayer. I can't address every Hotzenklotz that came along throughout history and try to mess with our traditions. But as I told a leader of the Reform movement here in Montana once asked me during when they were sitting Shiva, they asked me, when someone comes to you and says they want to be cremated, how do you convince them out of it? I said, me? I have no problem convincing them out of it. I tell them the truth, that they won't be resurrection of the dead. There's a lot of consequences. So the person said to me, but I don't believe in all that. So how am I supposed to convince them? My point to them was, if you don't believe in it, why do you actually care if they're cremated? I said, but if you're looking for a way to convince them, tell them that it's not green, it's not environmental friendly to be cremated. So maybe that will work. If the Talmud doesn't work and the mystical Zohar doesn't work, then try the EPA. Maybe that will work. Let's do our key points and wrap it up. Go ahead, Stana, the first four.
Key points on page
114.
Nefesh and Ruach are the two of the soul's components. Nefesh powers physical life, while Ruach drives ambitions, emotions, and feelings. After death, the Nefesh remains with the body, while Ruach disengages, and goes on to Gan Eden, paradise. Once the Ruach is no longer limited to material existence, it is accessible to all who wish to connect to it. Thus, when a person dies, our ability to spiritually connect with him or her is stronger and deeper than before. Though the nefesh remains in the grave, it retains a connection with the higher levels of the soul. The gravesite is thus a port where we can commune with the departed souls and ask them to intercede before God on our behalf. Over a course of a lifetime, the soul and body integrate and bond. Their separation at death is therefore painful to the soul.
Joe, wrap it up, the last five.
When the soul departs the body in stages, these stages correspond to prescribed periods of mourning. When we mourn, we are mourning not only for the deceased, but also with the deceased. Dignity and sensitivity are the underlying principles that guide and care of a corpse in its preparation for burial. This is because even after death, the body retains its special status of having been the container of the soul. Burial is of the highest priority in Jewish tradition and culture. When God takes a person's soul, we are tasked to return to the place in which God has fashioned it. Burial affirms two fundamental Jewish beliefs. A, our bodies aren't ours, they belong to God. B, there will be a resurrection of the dead in the Messianic era. Cremation makes it impossible to fulfill the mitzvah of burial. Cremation is also a rejection of the holiness of the body, God's ownership of the body, and the belief in resurrection.
Next Thursday, I believe is the 19th of November, it will be lesson 4, In Heaven's Name, Heaven, Hell, and Reincarnation. Please join us next Thursday here, 7 o'clock for the class. Any questions?